dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has been struggling mightily on behalf of America in that war, an unlikely front, one might say, but it's actually a central part of the battle space. American academia is our first guest. His name is Dr. Jason Hill, and he is a professor of the Honors Distinguished Faculty and Director of Teaching Practicum at DePaul University. He is also a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center and the author of numerous very important books, most of which have a philosophical bent to him, he being a PhD in philosophy after all, but a very important one most recently entitled We Have Overcome, An Immigrant's Letter to the American People. Dr. Hill, I have not spoken with you in a frightfully long time, and I apologize to you for that. You have had some difficulties, and I wish that we had been in closer touch, but I'm so pleased to have you with us to talk about them and the kinds of thinking you've been doing that have precipitated such difficulties on your campus of DePaul. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be back.
Well, let's start with some of those difficulties, if we can. You have been writing both in various books, but also in various other outlets, now notably at Front Page Magazine, the Horowitz Center's terrific online resource, about the assault on the State of Israel, anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, if you will. Give us sort of the backstory, if you will, on the grief that that caused you on the DePaul campus.
Well, yes, in April of this year, I wrote an article for The Federalist shortly after Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel was elected in his fifth term of office. And in that article, I defended, I gave a moral justification for why I think Israel has every right to annex what's called the West Bank. I prefer to call it by its proper Judea and Samaria, that Israel had fought a very defensive 1967 war, and that it should really have annexed Judea and Samaria immediately, but had fought an altruistic war. The people who call themselves Palestinians, but are actually Jordanian Arabs, that Israel, after it won that war, had assumed moral and ethical responsibility for those people when they really should have been transferred back to Jordan. I also, in the article, Frank, went on to say that Israel has every right to regard many of the Palestinian people living within its geographic borders as national security threats, because what they do is they vote terrorist organizations into power. They voted Hamas into power, and they voted Fatah, the Palestinian Authority's branch, which is a terrorist organization, let's be clear about that, into power. So I made the point that as national security threat, Israel also had every right, if it desired, to strip the Palestinians of their right to vote, because one does not have the right to vote terrorist organizations into power that are inimical to the interests of Israel. But more than that, actually, the charters of Hamas and the PA call for the obliteration of Israel and the elimination of Jewry from the area. Well, it created a great, all hell broke loose when the article came out, and the Students of Justice in Palestine, which is really a surrogate for Hamas on campus, I think they should be regarded as a terrorist organization. And the college Democrats, the Young Socialists, and about seven organizations made a petition to the president to have me dismissed and to have me attend a racial sensitivity workshop, which I steadfastly refused to attend. and to have me apologize and to have me censured. Well, the president decided not to censure me, but the acting provost and faculty council took it upon themselves to issue a very nefarious form of censure in which they labeled me as a racist, as harmful to the Palestinian people and Arabs in general, an advocate of war crimes, and advocating the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And so I retained legal counsel, and they also led a boycott against my classes. So I've had several classes boycotted. My summer class and some of my fall classes were boycotted. And the university, I think, persists in engaging in a campaign against my defense of American civilization, of Jewish civilization, of Israel. But more importantly, I think they're very, very angry because I'm also pointing out to what's taking place in the West and in America, which is the Islamicization of our culture. And they've never forgiven me for that.
I want to talk about all of these substantive points with you in our second block today, Dr. Hill, but just to sort of give our listeners a sense of what you have been subjected to, I wanted just to read something from an excellent critique of the conduct of your institution, DePaul University, and its faculty council by Dr. Richard Landis in a site I come across, the Augean Stables. And he quoted the concluding, I believe it's the concluding piece of this censure resolution that the faculty council adopted. And it says, quote, "The faculty council urges Professor Hill to seriously reconsider his positions on these issues, to take cognizance of the perspectives of other scholars on these issues, as well as the real harm his words have caused to students and other members of our community, and to refrain from abusing his freedom as a scholar in writing on controversial issues in the future." And I think the thrust of all of this, of course, was you need to be re-educated on these matters. And I just wanted to give you a quick chance to respond to these calls.
Well, of course, it's, you know, they have advocated or said that they've not shut down my right to free speech. But it does have a very chilling effect on free speech, because besides censoring me, it's telling me also that I need to be reeducated by Palestinians in a racial sensitivity workshop. And it's a dire warning against any kind of criticism against jihadism in this country, of which I take the Palestinian Students for Justice to be a part of, and also the BDS movements, which I have been very, very critical of, and also just in our culture, which is extremely anti-Semitic, anti-reason, anti-Western democracy, telling me, in effect, not to write any more controversial articles that would offend the sensibilities of these campus jihadists and Islamicists who wield a great deal of power on our campus.
Well, this is the subject to which we will turn after a very short break. Dr. Jason Hill, professor at DePaul University, is with us, and an extraordinary inspiration for this program, I know, and for our listeners, and I hope for the American people more generally. More with Dr. Hill straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Dr. Jason Hill, a man of great clarity about some of the challenges that we're facing to vital American interests, notably, but not exclusively, involving our most important ally in the Middle East, the State of Israel, but also internally here on not just our campuses, but in our society more broadly. You can catch up with some of his really important writings at the David Horowitz Freedom Center's wonderful online resource, Front Page Magazine. Check out his books, among others, Civil Disobedience and The Politics of Identity, when we should not get along. And most recently, we have overcome an immigrant's letter to the American people. And perhaps I could just pick up on that last point. You are an immigrant, Dr. Hill. You have come here and made, you know, in the way countless others have before you, the most of the kinds of opportunities this country provides. And unlike an awful lot of Americans, but I think as is true of an awful lot of immigrants, you appreciate this country. You have a love for it that is palpable in your writings and in your public speeches. This is obviously an affront to your colleagues and others on campus, including this so-called Students for Justice in Palestine. Give us just a bit of the flavor of that. When you say we have overcome, what are they missing, your critics?
Well, you know, I came here as a legal immigrant with $120 in my pocket and worked my way up 45 hours a week to go to college and then won a scholarship to do my PhD. And I think we're living, I wrote this book out of gratitude to the greatest republic that I think exists and the greatest country that exists on the face of the earth, America. And when I say that we have overcome, I think the 1964 Civil Rights Act ended legal discrimination against blacks in this country. That's all that a republic can guarantee. It can't stop private racism or people from having private thoughts. But that in this great republic, there are a multiplicity of opportunities that immigrants such as myself have taken advantage of. We have flourished, we have thrived in an age of Americophobia where a republic is attacked. And I wanted to say that there in this book, you know, I tell a story of not just of my life, but of other immigrants who came here legally with very little in their pockets, demanded nothing of America except that America place no obstructions in their path towards their lives and their efforts to flourish. And I see this as a benevolent, thriving republic that is open to immigrants, that loves legal immigrants, that rewards hard work, grit, tenacity, and resilience. I think what's missing from my colleague and the professoriate, basically, in America is the fact that they are so obsessed with their hatred of the free market enterprise, with capitalism, with the American sense of life. I cannot communicate the absolute hatred that exists among the professoriate.
This is a Marxist sentiment, or whence comes this attitude, as you see it?
Well, it's our universities, which are national security threats, really, because they're just propaganda machines that brainwash the students into this form of cultural Marxism. And I think postmodernism, which has been in ascendancy in this country since the 1960s, where social justice warriors and activism and advocacy have replaced authentic scholarship in the classroom.
Let alone the liberal exchange of ideas, right?
Exactly. And to teach Western civilization, Western ideas is seen as being complicit with white supremacist thinkers who have created philosophic systems to exploit minorities. I try to point out to my students that their own emancipatory vocabularies of resistance has come from these Western thinkers who have given them the tools to liberate themselves. The irony is really missed upon them.
Yeah. You know, speaking of ironies, as it happens just last night, Dr. Hill, I was at an event in Los Angeles in which a woman was honored, Dr. Karen Sigeman, who was fired from a teaching position, not at the university level, but at the high school level, for a comment she made that simply extolled the virtues of Western civilization. You know, it's really gotten to this where it is a firing offense to be doing what you're doing. Fortunately, I guess the institution of tenure has protected you against the worst of this retribution. But obviously, you're under excruciating pressure from student agitators as well as your colleagues and the university itself. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the students have led several boycott movements, which have been backed by the administration. I mean, when the acting provost of the university herself says that she extols the virtues of the students, and she approves of the manner in which they have registered their protest, which included, I must add, taking over an entire building and distributing thousands of leaflets with my picture on there calling for the institution to dump Hill. And I've been told that among certain Arab students, the term dump really means dump his body. And I've received death threats. I've had to have police escort on campus for the first 3 weeks after the article in the Federalist broke. And the university, you know, six departments in the university, for example, put on a dinner called Come and Celebrate the Censure of Professor Hill, in which I saw the name of my own home institution, the philosophy department, as a co-sponsor of that dinner. So there's been enormous pressure. But, I have a spine of steel, and I'm very resilient. And they really picked on the wrong person because I won't back down.
Well, this is to your great credit, needless to say, and we commend you for your courage, your clarity of vision, as I said, and your willingness to stand up to these bullies, and that's precisely what they are. Listen, you've written not only this provocative piece in The Federalist, but you've also been writing several others that are really important, and I just wanted to touch base on one or two of them in the remaining time we have with you today, and I hope you'll come back for a much longer visit. But you have called out this sort of social justice industry, and specifically the tie-in between the left and the Islamists, what I think of as the red-green axis. And you have warned that there is now, as a result of kind of this joint enterprise, if you will, truly a jihadist campaign underway inside our own country. And you pointed out something that really requires very close attention, and that is later this month, at least two of the candidates for the Democratic nomination for the presidency, Bernie Sanders and Julian Castro, are going to be speaking before a group called the Islamic Society of North America. Remind us what this group, known as ISNA, is about, and how it fits into this larger problem of the jihad inside our country.
Well, we must remember that this organization is a unit of the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been designated as a terrorist state, a terrorist organization, I should say.
Unfortunately, not in the United States, but in other countries, yes.
Yes. So they're a unit of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a terrorist organization. And I feel quite strongly that while I don't think that Julian Castro and Bernie Sanders might necessarily want to see Sharia law established in America, I think they're willing to make alliances because of their own, what I call Americophobia, that they exhibit, are willing to make unholy alliances with these very nefarious organizations in order to get their agenda across. In terms of Bernie Sanders, it is to establish a completely expropriative socialist government in this country. But more importantly, I think there's something politically nefarious going on in that I think they're trying to appeal to the Islamic vote and hoping that by making these alliances with people who hate the West and hate America as much as I think they do, are hoping to establish what I call sociocultural jihadism in this country, which is to align themselves with people who are so against our system of government or Bill of Rights or Constitution or laissez-faire capitalists. Well, it's not completely laissez-faire, but our free market enterprise system, to bring about a radical transformation through alliances with these institutions. I think this is lost on most people, but I think it's quite true.
I think it's quite true, too. And just, again, to put a fine point on it, in the piece that you wrote recently in Front Page, entitled The Rise of Cultural and Economic Jihadism in American Civilization, you dissect ISNA's actual policy purpose as part of this larger Muslim Brotherhood infrastructure in the United States. And Just remind us, if you would, Dr. Hill, about what is that purpose with respect to our Constitution, with respect to Sharia, with respect to Western civilization.
Well, I think, you know, the connection is that the goals of these Islamist and jihadist organizations is precisely to establish Sharia law in this country, which is completely incompatible, I think, with our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. And I think some of these politicians are willing to make what I call a Faustian bargain. That is, they'll do anything to undermine the foundation and the fabric of the Constitution and of our society in order to effect and bring into existence a radically new type of order.
Dr. Hill, I'm sorry we are hard out of time, but there is so much more to talk about. Would you please come back soon to give us a full hour to drill down on so many of these critical points? And we'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We have an opportunity to take stock, as we have each week, I'm happy to say, with one of the country's foremost experts on matters involving Asia, and most especially communist China. He is Gordon Chang, one of the go-to guys for not only this program, but Fox News and the National Interest, National Review, so many others. He is the author of three terrifically important books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and most recently, Losing South Korea, subject to which we will turn in a moment. But before we do, Gordon, I did want to get just an update from you about what you think is happening in Hong Kong at the moment, with some of the largest of the demonstrations over the past 11 weeks taking place this past weekend and doing so peaceably.
On Sunday, there was a rally and protest march of an estimated 1.7 million people. That's according to organizers. Probably was a little bit fewer people than that, but nonetheless, it's extremely impressive considering that there was a downpour at the time. This is showing Beijing and Carrie Lam, the Hong Kong chief executive, that the majority of people in Hong Kong are going to defend their society. And also, it's an indication that protests will go back to being not only large, but peaceful. And that's a message to the international community.
Yeah, and an important one. It's not just that they were doing this in the face of the downpour. They were doing this in the face of what's been ratcheting up in terms of the police repression of these demonstrations. So I think it's extraordinary, and I hope it's a moment when the United States government will be stepping up its pressure against the Chinese for their obvious intent to bring this to an end through whatever means are necessary at the expense of the people of Hong Kong and their freedom. Hong Kong is just one topic, of course, Gordon, that I want to make sure we're touching base with you on. There are several others. One of them is the latest developments in connection with Huawei, the conglomerate that the Chinese government clearly is using to try to control data and information transfers worldwide. Tell us what's going on in Washington as well.
This morning, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross told Maria Bartiromo of Fox Business that the Commerce Department was going to give a second 90-day exemption to Huawei. But Huawei is on the Commerce Department's entity list, which means that no American company can do business with it without getting a prior approval from Commerce. The importance of this, Frank, of course, is that Huawei is a national security threat. President Trump said that yesterday, and yet we are supporting its business. This is a critical time for Huawei. They're trying to develop chips and software to replace American parts that it's been buying, and we've given them the time to do that. Got to remember that the Osaka G20 at the end of June, President Trump came to an interim agreement with Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, whereby the Chinese would buy additional U.S. agricultural products, and we would give a reprieve to Huawei. Well, the Chinese didn't uphold their end of the bargain, but we honored our part. This is not good policy, considering all that's going on.
It's deeply troubling, needless to say. Gordon, you've been sounding the alarm about this for quite some time, as have we. The Committee on the Present Danger of China has done several programs focused on what Huawei is up to, what its control of the 5G sort of digital infrastructure of the world would mean for our security, as well as for our economy, for our alliance relationships, and so on. And it's deeply distressing that this life support continues to be thrown to this company that's clearly tied to Chinese security services, intelligence operations, and of course, the Chinese Communist Party. We will hopefully be able to keep the pressure on. I know that there's a lot of restiveness on Capitol Hill about this kind of arrangement, and it needs to be stopped. Gordon, let me turn to another part of your Asia portfolio. As I mentioned, you've recently published at Encounter Books a broadsheet about losing South Korea. There were events, two major events in South Korea over the weekend, and I want you to walk our listeners through what they entailed and what they mean for the future policy direction of this vital U.S. ally in the region.
August 15th marked two anniversaries for South Korea. One of them was the end of the Second World War, in other words, liberation from Japan for South Korea. The second was the founding of the Republic of Korea. President Moon Jae-in, in his speech, focused only on Japan, but there was a large rally in Seoul demanding that Moon be impeached. This is going to be a further division in South Korean society, and we got to remember that Moon is deeply anti-American, so the United States has an interest in what happens there, of course.
That enmity towards the United States, Gordon Chang, is one piece of the problem with Moon Jae-in, of course. Another is the affinity that he's exhibited for Kim Jong-un of North Korea and for the whole unification enterprise with the North on terms that sound an awful lot like those of Kim Jong-un. Yet there has been in recent days what seems to be kind of back-of-the-hand treatment by Kim of Moon and his whole idea of unification. They're continuing in the North to test missiles, which seem to be designed to threaten or even attack South Korea. What is your sense of what's going on that front? Is this some sort of South Korean version of Kabuki theater to deceive us about exactly how intimate the relationship is between the North Korean dictator and his South Korean counterpart?
This is absolutely fascinating, Frank. Moon Jae-in, his highest priority is to unify the two Koreas, and he's willing to do it on the terms of North Korea. In other words, a confederal state, which is one country, two governments. At the same time, Kim Jong-un is executing typical North Korean diplomacy, which is not to recognize South Korea, of course, but also to treat South Korean presidents poorly. They don't recognize their legitimacy, and Kim only wants to deal with the U.S. So we're seeing typical Kim family diplomacy at this moment towards South Korea.
And the idea is not to foreclose the possibility of South Korea's surrender to the North, I guess, if I'm hearing you rightly, but rather simply to increase the leverage that Kim has on Moon and thereby even further improve the likelihood that it will be very much a surrender on the North's terms. Is that right?
Yes. Because Moon wants unification so much, he is giving leverage to North Korea. Moon is deeply anti-American. In his inauguration speech, he didn't mention the U.S. alliance. We defend South Korea. A real indication, I think, that Kim looks at that and says that he can push Moon around. And so far, Kim is right on that.
Unfortunately, I'm quite sure that he's reading him right on that. Gordon, let me just say one last thing. We don't have time to get into it in detail, but I was very happy to see you writing a powerful warning to the United States about China's efforts to take a dominant position in not only 5G, but another very much related technology. And when you're looking particularly at their sort of use of, well, 5G wireless infrastructure and quantum computing and data mining and, you know, vast surveillance operations to create this security state on steroids, if you will. But the use by them and the pursuit by them of artificial intelligence is a clarion call published by you at the Gatestone Institute. Just very quickly, could you give us a minute on why this is so important?
Well, China's making important advances in artificial intelligence. And people say, and I think it's correct, that whoever dominates AI is going to be able to dominate the economy of the 21st century. We are ahead of China in most phases of AI, but the point is the Chinese are catching up fast, and they're catching up with the help of U.S. companies such as Google and Microsoft. And clearly what we want to do is to stop cooperation of those companies with China, because it involves, on balance, a leakage of U.S. tech to China in circumstances which are extremely disturbing. So, for instance, China is using American AI to help suppress Uyghurs in what it calls Xinjiang in its northwest. This is a crime against humanity, of course. American companies are complicit, and we need to have a national conversation about our tech cooperation with China.
Boy, that's so true. And I was struck by a comment recently by Peter Thiel, the founder of PayPal and a pretty big player in the Silicon Valley world, in which he essentially, I think, in as many words, accused Google of treason for what it is doing in this, among other respects, with the Chinese. And Gordon, about that security state apparatus and the contribution American companies are making, American investors are also making a contribution through, I think, mostly unwitting underwriting of some of the companies like Hikvision involved in it. And that's the subject for another day's conversation. But I appreciate, as I say, your very important piece on this subject at Gatestone Institute. Please check it out there, folks. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today, as always, and for really the clarion voice that you bring to so many of these issues. It's deeply appreciated that you share it with us, and we'll look forward to doing so again next week. Next up, we'll speak about much of this more with Joseph Bosco, a former senior official in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. That and more straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back to continue some of the conversation we've just had with Gordon Chang. I'm pleased to say, joined by Joseph Bosco. He is an attorney by training, Harvard trained at that, at the hands of, among others, Henry Kissinger, no less. He has nonetheless proven to be a very clear-eyed thinker about and articulate commenter on our current difficulties with communist China and those that are in prospect. He brings to it the benefit of experience in senior positions in the Department of Defense, having served, among other things, with the China desk in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Also had senior responsibilities for disaster and relief and humanitarian affairs in OSD. He these days writes brilliantly and frequently, often at The Hill. And it's always a pleasure to have a chance to catch up with him. Joe has contributed among other things, to our new Committee on the Present Danger, China, for which we're very grateful, but also for his visits with us from time to time. Joe, welcome back. Good to have you, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be with you.
Well, I would like to pick up on some of the things we've been talking about a little bit in recent weeks, Joe, and get your take on it. You've recently written about the choices that Xi Jinping, the dictator for life of communist China, has vis-a-vis Hong Kong. And I'd like to get your read on what those choices are likely to mean for, well, both the people of Hong Kong and the free world more generally.
Yeah, I think that Xi, along with many of us in this country, are sensing that we're at an inflection point. That is, the United States, or the West generally, and communist China. We're reaching a point of no return. It's going to go in one direction or another. Obviously, the promises made to Hong Kong under the one country, two systems formula have been and are being eroded almost daily by Beijing, and the people of Hong Kong see what's happening and don't like it and are rising up to oppose it. Xi Jinping knows that if they succeed, this will be, from his perspective and from the Communist Party's perspective, a terrible precedent for the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, the Falun Gong, the Christians, all others who are being persecuted by the communist regime in Beijing, who will also want to assert their rights and speak out against the oppression. So it's a critical decision point for him. Now, if he does make the decision to undertake a massive crackdown, such as Deng Xiaoping did at Tiananmen Square, he knows he's going to pay a huge price internationally. Not nearly as large as he should pay, and certainly not comparable to what was done in after Tiananmen Square, where the West more or less went on with business as usual. But he knows that formula is not going to apply this time. Nevertheless, his choices are unpleasant for him, and he may decide that there is no alternative to a massive use of force. Now, he may find a way to finesse it. Maybe he thinks he can outlast the demonstrators, as they did in 2014 with the umbrella movement. They wore them down, and eventually public opinion turned against the protesters. Seems to me that's a very tough bet this time, because it's not just a few thousand or even 50,000 protesters. You got up to 1 million or 2 million Hong Kongers who are in support of this, who also sense that this is a decision point. So it's a very, very tough. Now, we have something to say about that. The United States can affect Xi's calculus. I think we ought to be much more explicit in making it clear that there will be huge consequences. We're not going to go to war over this, but we're already in a trade war, and that could be accelerated. We haven't even really undertaken an information war, which I think we should be doing. Should have been doing for quite a long time, as we did in the Cold War and even World War II. We're not using the tools we have, and we're not taking advantage of the opportunities that the communist dictators are presenting us.
Amen. We have unfortunately sent some confusing signals that I fear are probably being read by Beijing as evidence that more conciliatory policies are on offer if they simply persist in playing hardball, that the pressure on the president as he nears re-election, on the economy specifically, will be able to be played, shall we say, by them to advance their interests. And the idea that we will see the trade deal endlessly held over his head as an inducement to accommodate Beijing. Walk us through, as you understand it, Joe Bosco, the toing and froing as a sort of case in point with respect to Huawei. We've talked with Gordon about the announcement by Wilbur Ross this morning that another waiver was going to be given to this outfit that is an instrument of the Chinese Communist Party, right?
Well, you use the term toing and froing, Frank, and this couldn't be a more dramatic example of it. Just yesterday, the president, in one of his offhand briefings with the press, stated that there would be no further extensions to Huawei, to the prohibition on Huawei. He was specifically asked that by a reporter, that there had been rumors to that effect, that we were about to give an extension, and he denied it and said those rumors are totally wrong. It's the opposite is the case. Well, lo and behold, today, Commerce did in fact give the very extension that the president said would not be granted. So, you know, there's a certain lack of clarity at the high levels of our government on this.
And that's putting it very mildly. One might say incoherence, unfortunately. And again, I'm afraid, and you know these guys better than I do, Joe, but isn't it likely that this is going to only reinforce the worst impulses of the Chinese communist dictatorship?
Yeah, I think that's manifestly the case. And it's not just the Chinese communists. It's also the North Korean communists, or whatever they call themselves nowadays. And Russia and Iran and others are watching and seeing that the administration oftentimes issues very strong rhetorical declarations, but then at some point things turn around and the worst does not occur. And so every time that happens, we lose a little bit of credibility. If you were Xi Jinping or Kim Jong-un, why would you not say, I think I might be able to wait this administration out?
And that seems to be very much their purpose at the moment. Which brings me to sort of the larger context for all this, Joe. And you had a recent piece, I believe at The Hill, about China as freedom's enemy. And this, of course, is the context within which we need to be thinking about our position vis-a-vis Hong Kong, but also on trade and also with respect to South China Sea Islands and the Belt Road Initiative and so on. Just in, you know, the shortest of short forms, tell us about why this is such a problem and not a product of the trade war, as it's called, but something that's been an abiding problem now for decades.
It really has. I think it goes back to the formation of the Chinese Communist Party. After all, international communism sees or saw the West as its mortal enemy, and they were opposed to our system, our sets of values. They perceive them correctly as a threat to their own regimes and their own ways of governing. So it's not a new formula. I kind of chuckle when people say that, well, this is a new threat we're being presented with by China. It's never gone away. I remember Mike Green said at a CSIS conference, we didn't get China wrong, we got Xi Jinping wrong. No, we've been getting China wrong for 40 or more years. And yeah, they are an enemy of freedom, whether it's the one-fifth of the population that's within the boundaries of China, so-called China. Their freedoms are clearly being suppressed and denied. But it's more than that. Beijing intends to export its system, certainly to its neighbors, and now through the incredible capacities of technology, Huawei and the rest of it, they spread these ideas elsewhere. They have extraterritorial reach. They suppress free speech in other countries.
Joe, we have to leave it at that, I'm sorry to say. I hope that you will come back for an hour conversation with us at some point soon, as there is so much to talk about, and I appreciate your spending some time with us. Joe, we will talk with you soon, and I hope the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.